but it's not going to be examined. Okay, so you can have a look at that in more detail at your leisure. The aims and objectives, I think, is also quite useful, because what that does is go through each chapter, giving you a sort of overarching aim and a series of more specific objectives of things that you would expect to be able to do by the end of that chapter. I've left out chapter 1 because that's just a resume of things from GR1. But for 2, 3, as you can see, there's lots of stuff for chapter 3. Chapter 4, 5, which is very qualitative, and then chapter 6. And I did include some aims and objectives for chapter 7 back before I realised I was going to have to miss a lecture. So the other document, the more detailed list of what you need to know and don't need to know, overrides this. But in an ideal world where we did have 11 lectures this year, then these are the things that I would have wanted people to take away from chapter 7. I'd still quite like to take those things away from chapter 7, but they're not going to be examined, which I guess at this point in the year is the main thing that people want to know. Do you know the dates of the exams yet? No, I think they'll be officially published on Monday, is what I've heard. There is a draft timetable that I got to see earlier this week while I was travelling, and I'm afraid I can't remember when the GR exam is, but I think it will be made official by registry in the early days of next week. And it's at least a month away. I mean, it's more like probably 5 or 6 weeks away, but I can't confirm that. I think it's into May, but we'll know that for sure within a few days. The exams are fairly spread out though, so I can't remember how spread out. As I say, it was a spreadsheet containing exam dates for the entire university, which had just kind of passed before my eyes, and I was trying to look for the astro and the physics ones, but can't swear to when they are. Okay, so what I'd like to do today then, and we've also got a tutorial, but we'll have a wee bit of a break in the middle, is spend the first hour, first 50 minutes or so, and completing discussion of chapter 6. I'm only at 45 minutes now, we're 3:15 already. And then we'll have a break for 10 minutes and then I'll do some tutorial examples. It's really just up to you which ones you want me to do. All the tutorial sheets have been in the web for a while, but all the solutions are now on there as well, and I'll just leave them up for the next couple of months until after the exams are over. So where we'd got to, it's a wee while, we skipped a week because I was away, so the last lecture was, oh, I don't know when, about 2 weeks ago. We'd got to a discussion of these diagrams, these space-time diagrams, and in particular the fact that in this transform coordinate system, where you've still got a spatial variable r, but your time coordinate is t twiddle, then what you can show is that the world lines, or the light cone, equally useful phrase, the light cone tips over, which means that the world lines of photons always are constrained to prevent even photons from getting back out once you've crossed the event horizon or the Schwarzschild radius. Okay? Now, again, just to see how rarefied environment we're in terms of you knowing stuff that other people don't know. Wednesday, I had the great privilege to get on my way back from this workshop I was at in Caltech, just an hour to pass through the Griffith Observatory, which is in Los Angeles, and they have recently reopened, refurbished it, and they've got the Leonard Nimoy Event Horizon Presentation Theatre. And somebody came on just before they showed us a talk about it and said, "Does anyone know what an event horizon is?" And I thought, well, I won't put my hand up, I'll keep quiet. But there wasn't a single person who was prepared to sort of put their hand up and say. And I dare say lots of people who were in that crowd had a vague idea what an event horizon was. But what hopefully we've done in this chapter, even though we've not talked much about black holes, is given you a sense that it's not just all airy-fairy science fiction stuff, that there is a rigorous mathematical framework for defining the properties of black holes. And we're going to extend that a wee bit now. The bit that we left off with was just the remark that once you've crossed the event horizon, photons can't get out, but photons and indeed even food parcels can still get in. So we discussed the fact that the spaceship which had gone inside can still be intercepted by photons or by material particles, but it can't get back out again. Okay, so that's where we left off, and what I want to pick up with now is 6.5. Does anyone get any questions or comments before we do on stuff from last time, anything you've been reading over and puzzling about? Okay, well if not, then save them all up for the tutorial at 4, but we'll meanwhile go on with 6.5. How black are black holes? What we want to address here is, it's a rather simplistic argument, but we're going to try to work out how long it would take a black hole to fade from view. And the reason this isn't like a trivial question is that you might remember at the beginning of the previous lecture we showed a sort of curious result. We showed that the coordinate time it would take a photon to reach the event horizon is actually infinite. Now what that meant was that to a distant observer who basically sees flat space-time and therefore just measures coordinate time as time, it would take an infinite amount of time for a photon to reach a distant observer. So what that might lead you to think then is that when the black hole is forming, or indeed even if it has already formed and you're just considering material that's falling in towards it, like a spaceship or a photon, then wouldn't you just see it kind of frozen at the event horizon? Because the time it would take the photon to reach the event horizon from your point of view as a distant observer would just be stretching out ever more and ever more, so that formally it takes an infinite amount of time for it to reach the event horizon. I remind you that it doesn't actually take an infinite amount of proper time. From the point of view of a spaceship falling in, the time it takes you to reach the event horizon is finite, and as we mentioned last time, you'd have other things to worry about, like the tidal stretching, spaghettification, but nonetheless you would still get there in a finite time. We're talking about how it would appear to a distant observer. So as I've said here, doesn't this mean that as a massive star undergoes spherical collapse, a distant observer would see the light just before it collapses kind of frozen at the event horizon? So we're going to show that that's not in fact the case, and we are going to show it in a slightly simplified framework, because I'll just scroll up there. Okay, because we're going to do it all for the Schwarzschild metric. Now the Schwarzschild metric's only supposed to be for a static star, whereas we're busy thinking about a star that's collapsing, so strictly speaking we shouldn't be using the Schwarzschild metric for that. But the true metric would then be evolving in time, and you'd get maybe gravitational waves giving off, all sorts of nasty stuff like that that would make the calculations harder. So it's much easier just to work with the Schwarzschild metric, because the crucial effect that explains why the black hole will disappear from view very quickly is already there in the Schwarzschild metric. In chapter 3, we derive for the Schwarzschild metric an equation that described the gravitational redshift of light emitted at the coordinate radius Re and observed at coordinate radius R0. And the gravitational redshift Z, which is the difference between the observed wavelength and the emitted wavelength divided by the emitted wavelength, well, we had a formula for it, and basically when the light is emitted at the Schwarzschild radius, then Re equals Rs, so that's going to go to infinity. So that means that the wavelength of the light that's coming to you as the light reaches the event horizon, it might take an infinite amount of time for the light to get there, but it's also stretched to infinite wavelength, which of course our eyes can't see. And moreover, because the wavelength is increasing and heading towards infinity, the energy of the light is also decreasing. If you think of it as a photon, it's hc over lambda. Lambda's going to infinity. The light's getting redder and redder. So that is really why the gravitational effect produces a black hole that really does fade from view. It isn't just that you see the light forever frozen at the event horizon, because that same light that's being frozen at the event horizon is also having its wavelength stretched formally to infinity, so you don't see it. It passes out of the visible window So in that sense, it really does disappear, and we can quantify that in a moment. So if we think about this in terms of luminosity, we want to ask ourselves, what would be the luminosity of the star as it collapses compared with the luminosity which it would have had if there was none of this weird general relativity going on at all? So we've got light being emitted from the star radially at coordinate TE and RE, so we're just considering one dimension really because it's spherically symmetric. And then you're observing a distant observer who is at coordinates TO and RO. So the luminosity that the distant observer would, well, you don't observe luminosity, you'd have to infer that. You'd observe a flux, and if you know how far away the thing is, you can work out the luminosity. But the key equation is that the luminosity you would deduce is the luminosity that would be in the absence of any GRFX divided by 1 plus Z squared. So you ask yourself, where does the 1 plus Z squared come from? Well, this is a bit analogous to the redshifting due to the expansion of the universe. It's the same idea. Instead of the universe expanding, it's the star that's collapsing. But it's a very analogous effect. Suppose you might say that if you designed a coordinate system in which the star was fixed, then a collapsing star, if you transform to a fixed coordinate system, that would be like the rest of the universe expanding. Okay, so it's not surprising that the result turns out to be the same, is that L observed at coordinate time TO is the luminosity that the star would have if it weren't collapsing, divided by 1 plus Z squared. So the reason it's 1 plus Z squared is that every photon that comes from the star is first of all being redshifted by a factor of 1 plus Z because of the gravitational redshift. Just like in a cosmological setting, photons are redshifted by the expansion of the universe, which can be thought of as a similar effect. But secondly, the arrival times of the photons are also being stretched out. Okay? Just like we said before, in a sense the photons are being frozen at the event horizon, but that's not all. They're also having their redshift stretched. And the two effects taken together both influence the observed luminosity, because luminosity is the amount of energy that reaches you per unit time. So less energy is reaching you, and it's taking longer for the energy to get there. Okay? So that's why it goes as LC over 1 plus Z squared. Okay? Now, this ray of light that we're imagining coming from the event horizon to us, well, coming from RE to us, but we'll look at what happens in the limit the event horizon in a moment. It's a null geodesic, so that means that ds squared is going to be zero. So what we can do is we can integrate dt, the coordinate time from t emitted to t observed, and we set that equal to the integral of dr over 1 minus 2m over r. Okay, so where does that come from? So ds squared is zero, so that means that dt squared is equal to dr squared over 1 minus 2m over r. No, didn't get that right. Almost right. I was thinking there should be a squared, but of course I've sort of mentally already taken it over to the right hand side. Maybe it would be better if I write this on the board to make sure I get it right. If you look at what the Schwarzschild matrix says, any blank board somewhere, here's a bit. So the Schwarzschild matrix would look like this. It's 1 minus 2m over r dt squared. In fact, that should have a minus sign in front. Plus dr squared over 1 minus 2m over r. Plus a term involving d theta squared and a term involving d phi squared. But if it's a radial path, those are both zero. Okay, so nothing controversial there. This is equal to ds squared. But because it's a photon, ds squared equals zero. So that means that we can write, if we take, well, let's do it in two stages, just to make sure I don't get it wrong. Dr squared over 1 minus 2m over r equals dt squared times 1 minus 2m over r. Okay, so all I've done is I've taken the Schwarzschild metric, I've set the radial coordinates, or rather the angular coordinates equal to 0 because it's a radial path, and I've said because it's a photon, ds squared equals 0, so that bit has to equal that bit. Alright, and then what I can do is I can take the 1 minus 2m over r down to here, so that I've only got stuff involving coordinate radius on one side, and only got stuff involving coordinate time on the other. And then I take the square root of both sides, and that's me got a differential equation for dr, or involving dr, on one side, and a differential equation involving dt on the other side. Okay, so that's where 618 comes from. Okay, so we've just got the dt integral from te to to, and the dr integral. And we can write that as dr over 1 minus rs over r. So, you know, that's just one of those funny integrals involving logarithms. I've just kind of given you that. It's easy to verify that if you integrate that right-hand integral, then you get r plus rs times log of small r minus rs. How does that help us? Well, now it means that we can do the integration. So we got to minus te equals ro minus re plus the Schwarzschild radius times that logarithmic term. So let's suppose that the photon is emitted at te equals 0. Then we get log re minus rs over ro minus rs equals minus t naught minus ro minus re over the Schwarzschild radius. And a bit of rearrangement, well, not rearrangement, just exponentiate both sides first of all. You get equation 621. Term on the left-hand side is proportional to e to the minus t naught over rs. And from 616, what we can do is then note that the term on the left-hand side, well, we already knew what that was from the equation for gravitational redshift. So from 616, let's just go back and find that. Yeah, there we are. Okay, so 616 is an equation that says that 1 plus z is equal to re times r0 minus rs all over r0 times re minus rs. That comes from chapter 3. So I've just substituted that now into equation 622. Okay. And then linked 622 and 621. So that what I can say is that the luminosity, remember we argued that the luminosity that you see at t naught, at some coordinate time t naught, will be related to the luminosity in the absence of any GR effects and a non-collapsing star divided by 1 plus z squared. So now I've just put in what 1 plus z squared is and related that to e to the minus t naught over rs. All of that had been done in terms of the speed of light equal to 1. If we explicitly put the speed of light back in, then what it says is that the luminosity divided by the luminosity before the star collapses is proportional to e to the minus c t naught over rs. So the luminosity drops exponentially. So the luminosity falls off exponentially, and also in a very short time scale. The time scale is the time it would take the light to cross the Schwarzschild radius. So even if you had a black hole with the mass of the Sun, the Schwarzschild radius of that is only a few kilometers. So it only takes a tiny fraction of a second for light to cross that. So it only takes a tiny fraction of a second for the luminosity to drop by a factor of e to the minus 1, and so within a few seconds the luminosity will have faded exponentially fast to be so dim that you just wouldn't be able to see it. Now we haven't said what the constant of proportionality is, so it's a bit hard to turn this into a magnitude. I had a crack at that when I taught this course the first time, but I was making too many sort of dodgy assumptions. I just, well, basically said, let's assume that the constant of proportionality is just one, and see how quickly a black hole would become so faint that even the Hubble telescope couldn't see it. Well, I say that's not really a terribly helpful calculation, because the constant of proportionality maybe isn't one, but the point is, it's still going to decay exponentially. So whether it takes a few minutes or a few hours, the black hole is still going to fade from view, because however bright the star is to begin with, the combination of these two effects, the light taking an infinite time to reach us, but also at the same time being stretched to infinitely long wavelengths, means that all the energy that the star is giving out is no longer accessible to us. We're not seeing that luminosity anymore, so therefore calling it a black hole really is not such a bad assumption. But recall that this only happens at the Schwarzschild radius. Okay, so if you have a black hole that's formed and is then surrounded by a disk of material that's not at the Schwarzschild radius but is further out than that, then there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to see that disk of material. It's only really when you get very close to the Schwarzschild radius that the redshift becomes very great and the time dilation becomes really great, so the luminosity of the black hole really, you know, sort of drops exponentially fast. So what I'm meaning by that is that we shouldn't be surprised to still be able to see the accretion disk around a black hole. Now, we haven't talked about that at all in this course, but the fifth years, those of you who did the high energy astro course with me last year will recall some discussion of that. It came up in the galaxies course as well, because we talked about the standard model for active galactic nuclei, which is a supermassive black hole surrounded by an accretion disk. So we might not be able to see the black hole itself or the event horizon by the argument we've just gone through, but you can still see, in many cases, the accretion disk surrounding that. And indeed, I've got some notable examples, which, just bear with me for a minute and I'll dig out. But for those of you who... Well, basically, has everybody here done the high energy astro? Because if you have, then there's no much point in me showing you the pictures again, and you've kind of seen them before. But there's one I'll dig out, because it's one of my favourites. It's from the Hubble Space Telescope, and it's particularly striking because it's really the first time that we had such a decent view of the inner part of the accretion disk. In fact, I'll just dig out the image that I used in the first year course, because it's easier to locate. Part 1, Lecture, Cosmology. Here we are. If my laptop opens reasonably quickly. Right, that's the sort of thing I'm thinking about. You know, this is sort of colloquially described as the Hubble telescope showing us a supermassive black hole in the core of a quasar. Well, of course it's not, it's just showing you the accretion disk around it, and that accretion disk is still of order 400 light years across. So the Schwarzschild radius would be way, way, way smaller than even a single pixel of the Hubble telescope image. And if you were looking on that scale, then the argument we've just gone through says that basically you wouldn't get any light coming from the Schwarzschild radius, because it will be redshifted infinitely and will take an infinite amount of time to get there. So we deduce the properties of the black hole from what we see around, as we discussed in that high energy course last year for the astros. Folks doing theoretical physics maybe won't have had the chance to get that course, but nonetheless, from an astrophysical point of view, it's an important point to note, is that, you know, all this stuff about black holes, it's not just speculation. We are really pretty confident that black holes do exist because of the circumstantial evidence that we see from galaxies like this one, and indeed stars. Okay, so that's an algebraic argument that's a bit simplified, because we're applying the Schwarzschild metric to a collapsing star, which we shouldn't really, but it's still spherically symmetric, and if you apply the Schwarzschild metric, what you deduce is that the time scale for the star to dip in brightness exponentially is very, very short. It's just the light crossing time of the Schwarzschild radius, which is going to be a fraction of a second. Okay, so we're very nearly done. The last item that was a bullet point that I did want you to regard as examinable is concerning rotating black holes. And that last bullet point was a purely qualitative one. It was just to be able to describe the basic picture of what's interesting and unusual about rotating black holes. But since there is time, I do propose to go through a bit more of it, a bit of the equations as well, but I'll highlight the bit that you need to take on board, and you can largely ignore the rest really, although it's quite interesting all the same. So a rotating black hole, the solutions to Einstein's equations that describe a rotating black hole are termed a Kerr black hole, the Kerr metric, which is a metric in which you have a point mass which is rotating, and that means that it's described by more than just its mass, because it's also got angular momentum. So one of the parameters that describes the metric is how much angular momentum the black hole has. If it's rotating faster, it will have more angular momentum. So what is the Kerr metric? Well, we don't derive it. I've read derivations of it in a book. It's much harder than deriving the Schwarzschild metric, and there isn't time. So I'm just going to state the form of the metric rather than deriving it. Okay? There are two constants. The Schwarzschild metric had one constant, m, which we associated with the mass of the star. In this case, we've got m, and we've also got j, which is a constant that we can associate with the angular momentum in the weak field limit. At least it's a magnitude of the total angular momentum. Angular momentum's a vector, whereas j here is a scalar, so it's just a magnitude of it. And the parameter that we'll introduce is a, which is the ratio of the two. So it's the ratio of the magnitude of the angular momentum to the Newtonian mass. And we'll see that the line element, just over the page, is a bit ugly, so much so that it barely fits on one line. But it's not a million miles different from the Schwarzschild metric. In particular, if you set A equals 0, then it will reduce back down to the Schwarzschild metric form. And related to that, you can see that there is an extra term. There's a dt d phi term. So it's not an orthogonal metric. That term wouldn't be there for the Schwarzschild metric, but remember, as I said, if you set A equals 0, then that term will vanish, and you're back to a static metric again. Okay? But this is the form the metric takes. All you need to note from that is that it's not diagonal. And the fact that the metric isn't diagonal, which means, to use the terminology we introduced at the beginning of the course, it's not orthogonal, that mathematically brings about this quite amazing physical effect, which is that if you launch towards this black hole a particle which doesn't have any angular momentum, then it will still acquire some angular velocity. It won't just fall radially inwards, it will wind up rotating around the black hole. It's kind of being dragged round by the space-time. And this is just a test particle. You know, what we're really saying is that space-time itself is being dragged round. And, you know, you can map out how that space-time is being dragged round by throwing test particles at your black hole. You know, not a very realistic experiment, but, you know, not as crazy as you might think, because, see, the meeting I was at earlier this week, one of the topics we were discussing was using the next generation of gravitational wave detectors, principally LISA and a ground-based one, to look at stellar mass black holes falling into supermassive black holes, and they would be like test particles falling into a Kerr metric, and then you could map out the space-time and see whether it obeys what the Kerr metric says it does, and in particular, whether the space-time is being dragged round, this frame dragging effect. So 20 years from now, this is the sort of experimental observational astrophysics we might be able to do, but not quite yet. So how does it work? Why is it that space-time gets dragged round by a rotating black hole? And in actual fact, gets dragged round by the Earth. It's just that the effect is so tiny that you wouldn't ever expect to be able to really measure it for the Earth unless you put up a dedicated satellite to make very careful measurements. One such satellite has been put up called Gravity Probe B. I'll give you a website if you want to find out more about that. But the results aren't actually very good. Don't think it's GR's fault, I think it's just that the satellite maybe hasn't achieved its design spec. So let's stick to the theory, which is solid and reliable, unlike satellites that often don't work, and see where the prediction comes from. So first of all, let's go all the way back to chapter 1. This is the equation of the geodesic. Instead of writing it as dx alpha by d tau, we've just written it as v alpha, because that's the definition of the four velocity, dx alpha by d tau. So the geodesic equation in that form with velocities instead of positions is 628. And we can rewrite that in turn as 629. All we've done there is we've used the chain rule on dv alpha by d tau. So we've written that as dv alpha by dx beta times dx beta by d tau, which we can write as v beta. Okay? Another way we can write that is in terms of covariant derivatives, because the covariant derivative will involve a term that includes the Christoffel symbols. So we can write that as v beta v alpha covariantly differentiated with respect to beta. And in fact, this is really how you would define a geodesic. One way you can define a geodesic is a curve which parallel transports its own tangent vector, and that's really what that equation means. Okay, although I didn't develop, well, I didn't do GR1 anyway, Norman did, so maybe he said this sort of stuff to you. But when I've taught GR1 before, I usually develop the equation of the geodesic slightly differently and talk about it as an extremal path, like a path which is an extremum when you work out the interval, the ds squared. But you can approach the definition of a geodesic in this manner. They both kind of really mean the same thing. It's like, just as you would say a straight line is the shortest distance between two points, well, that doesn't work anymore in curved space-time, but you can define the geodesic equation in curved space-time equivalently, and that's what it boils down to. Okay, now we need that because it's going to help us to understand this frame-dragging result. So you can get another version of the previous equation by noting that we can write v alpha with upper indices, that's the contravariant form of a vector. We can write that as the covariant form of the vector components v sigma multiplied by the metric. The metric is a way of changing lower to upper indices. Okay? And then that means that we can show that v alpha times v beta semicolon alpha equals zero. So what's different from the previous one? Not a lot, it's just that we've lowered the second index. Okay, we've actually flipped them round, but that doesn't matter so much. And that result holds because the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. And there's a wee example on sheet 5 that goes through that. Okay, we're almost there. The reason we're doing all of this is so that we can wind up writing something down in terms of momentum. So what we do is we introduce the four momentum now. Of course, this would work in any number of dimensions, but we'll go with four. We've got the rest mass times V alpha is P alpha, and the same with covariant components. So because the rest mass is constant, that means that 632 is equivalent to 634. All we've done is we've multiplied by m squared, split up the m's, taken one with the first v, one with the second v, and then we've got p upper alpha, p lower beta, all covariantly differentiated with respect to alpha equals zero. And then if we explicitly write out what the covariant derivative would be, it will involve Christoffel symbols. But because it's equal to zero, then that means that we can write P alpha, P beta, comma alpha equals the terms involving the metric and its derivatives. It's a little bit of tidying up of the algebra to be done, isn't there always? And what that gives us is the following. It says mv alpha times dp beta by dx alpha, so that's the partial derivatives with respect to coordinate x alpha of the beta component of p, that has to equal a half g nu alpha comma beta. So it involves the derivative of the metric components with respect to beta times p nu p alpha. Okay, it's just a bunch of Greek letters. What does it all mean? The significance is really this term, because it says that if the components of the metric don't depend on coordinate beta, then the right hand side equals zero. Okay? Because g nu alpha doesn't depend on beta, so its derivative with respect to beta is zero. And then that means that m v alpha dp beta by dx alpha also has to be zero. Okay, so that means that p beta has to be a constant along the geodesic. It doesn't vary with respect to tau, because we can write that expression on the extreme left of 637, we can write it as m dp beta by d tau. So that's like a tangent vector of p beta along the geodesic, and it's equal to zero. Okay? So p beta is constant along the geodesic. So that's the math bit. To see physically why that's important, unfortunately it's just over the break in the page, so I'll do this slowly so you get a chance to read it properly. So what you're saying is, if you can find one of the coordinates that the components of the metric don't depend on, then the results that we derived previously say that a material particle will preserve that component of its momentum along geodesics. Okay? So the metric components don't depend on phi. The Kerr metric, the metric components depend on theta, but not on phi. So the previous result says that p phi should be conserved along geodesics. But the result we derived, see, the maths trick involved deriving a result that was the contravariant component of p. So it's the contravariant component p phi which is conserved along the metric. I should have said the covariant, I'm sorry, the covariant component. That's p lower phi. What if you wanted p upper phi, the contravariant component? Well, that's related to p lower in the usual way, using the metric to change a lower index into an upper index. Okay? Now, normally, if you've got an orthogonal metric, then it would only be the g phi phi term you'd have to worry about. But we don't have an orthogonal metric. G phi t is also non-zero. So we've got to include that term as well. That's where 638 comes from. The second term in 638 would be zero if you had an orthogonal metric. For the Kerr metric, because it's not orthogonal, it's non-zero. And then p upper index t, similarly, that's gt alpha p alpha. So you get gtt, as you would always have for an orthogonal metric, but you also get gt phi, which is the same as g phi t. Okay. So various bits of math now at our disposal, and the physical insight that they give us is the following. If you start off with a material particle with zero angular momentum, that means that p phi equals zero, and then we ask ourselves, what would p upper index phi be what would peer for index T be, that will allow us to work out d phi by dt, which is the angular velocity that the material particle has, as measured by a distant observer. Remember, it's the same idea that we used earlier in this chapter. To a distant observer, space-time is flat, so the coordinate time is really just like the proper time that they would measure. It's only when you're close to the black hole that things look weird. So to a distant observer, d phi by dt is just what they would define the angular velocity of that particle to be. So d phi by dt is p phi over pt. The expressions for p phi and pt we can get in terms of d phi by d tau and dr by d tau, but we've also got them in terms of the metric components. And the crucial point, really, is that g upper index phi t is not zero. Okay? So basically, most things cancel out, but what you wind up with is, you know, remember, we've started off with a particle which has got zero angular momentum, so p phi is zero. So that term vanishes, but you've still got gtt pt, and then the bit that's just disappeared from up above. In 638, the first term p phi is zero, but you've still got g phi t pt. So whatever pt is, doesn't matter because it cancels. But what you wind up with is g phi of t, or g phi t, not phi of t, so used to saying that in other contexts, divided by gtt. These are metric components, the top one of which would be zero for the Schwarzschild metric, but for the Kerr metric it isn't zero. And that is the crucial reason why our particle, despite starting off with zero angular momentum, acquires angular velocity. Okay? So what am I talking about here? I'm really talking about throwing something along a radial path, but basically as it travels towards the massive object, the black hole, it winds up going, acquiring an angular velocity. It winds up moving transverse to the line of sight. Not an effect we would expect to see for the Earth, although there was nothing at all in our derivation that required this to be a black hole. It's just that black holes really are the only objects where the effects should be strong enough that they'll be very easy to see. But the result, the qualitative bit, the bit that you, I want you to take away from this, even if the maths that I've just gone through remains a bit opaque, is the following. That if you throw a zero angular momentum particle towards a rotating Kerr black hole, an object described by the Kerr metric, then it acquires a non-zero angular velocity. And the essential reason why it happens is because the form of the metric is not orthogonal, which means g phi t is not zero, even though it would be if it was a static metric. Okay? So we're now really just in the realms of trying to think of back of the envelope sort of metaphors for what's going on. But the way that people usually say it is that the intense gravity is dragging the particle round in the same sense as its own rotation. So it's dragging space-time around. So the particle starts off moving in an inertial frame. It's got no angular velocity. So it stays in that inertial frame, but we think of the inertial frame itself being dragged round by the intense gravity of the central object. And as I said, there's nothing in what we've presented here, albeit very quickly, and I realise I'm not going to have time for Hawking radiation after all. There's nothing which requires it to be a black hole, so this should work for the Earth as well. It should work for any rotating object. And Gravity Probe B was launched a few years ago by Stanford to try to measure this frame dragging using gyroscopes and, you know, a sort of fairly clever experimental setup that was based on looking at distant stars as a sort of an inertial reference frame and to see whether they were changing as the inertial frames got dragged round by the Earth's rotation. So the problem with Gravity Probe B's results, I think, is just that the error bars are a lot bigger than they'd expected, which means while it certainly doesn't rule out frame dragging, it doesn't conclusively confirm it the way that they had hoped. So we have to wait a bit longer for confirmation, but you know, Einstein's passed all these other tests. I should mention that the other thing I got at the Griffith Observatory, aside from a tour of the Leonard Nimoy event horizon, was an Einstein action figure, which I meant to bring along today. But available via the internet if anybody wants one. But nonetheless, that, it would seem, is one of the weird effects of GR, that a particle moving along a zero angular momentum path will actually acquire angular velocity. It will be dragged round as the space-time is dragged round by the rotation. And in some sense, this is an effect which, albeit really tiny, has to be taken into account with things like the GPS system. The main effect for GPS is that clocks run faster at high altitude than at low altitude. But if you were looking for incredibly precise timing with GPS, then you would also have to take this frame dragging effect into account. Okay, so I guess that's me about out of time, and I'm sorry that yet again